Did you know that you can be a critically thinking, rational person and be a Christian? Did you know that there's good evidence that Christianity is true? Did you know that the Christian faith can withstand the toughest of scrutiny? Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we believe because of the brains God gave us and not in spite of them. I'm your host, Evan Minton. Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we use the brains that God gave us. Today, we're going to be talking about the Book of Acts. The Book of Acts is the first history book in the New Testament after the four Gospels. It follows the development of the early church, starting with the ascension of Jesus, and then it moves on to Pentecost and we read about the conversion of Saul of Tarsus and the Apostle Paul and all of his missionary journeys. But just how reliable of a historical document is the Book of Acts? I think it's pretty clear that the Book of Acts is, its genre is meant to be historical narrative, but how far can we trust it? How much did the author get right? Well, today I have Christian apologist and YouTuber Eric Manning on the show to talk about this topic. Eric, it's good to have you on the show.
Yeah, Evan, thanks so much for having me.
So, first, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So again, my name's Eric Manning, and I run the YouTube channel Testify, or people can just look up the handle Testify Apologetics. And so basically my main interests are historical apologetics, like the reliability of the Gospels. Of course, the Book of Acts would fit into that category as well. And a lot of my videos are kind of focused on that, defending the Gospels against skeptical claims. I'm also interested in just the argument for miracles in general. And so whether it's Humean objections to miracles or just talking about the evidence from modern miracles that people still experience today, those are kind of my main apologetic interests. Before I started the channel, I wrote the blog isjesusalive.com, which has been around for about 5 years. I've just always been drawn to history and these kind of things in theology, and so it's just kind of a good way for my interest to converge, I guess.
Yeah, I remember back when I was doing an in-depth study of the historical reliability of the Gospels to prepare for my blog series, which also is a podcast series. I found your videos to be very helpful. I binged watched them, and I think I watched almost all of them, in addition to the very large stack of books that I had that included authors like Craig Blomberg, Titus Kennedy, Lydia McGrew, Brant Petrie, and so on. Yeah. And so, for listeners, like, do check out Testify. It's a very good resource to learn about why you ought to trust the Gospels. He's got some long videos. He's got some short videos. He's got videos of all different kinds.
Thanks so much. I noticed. I think I know when you were binge watching, because I noticed. Yeah. Like, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, Evan's commenting, so.
I went on to, I kind of cast it to my TV from my phone, and I left a lot of comments.
Yep, no, I appreciate it. Helps the algorithm.
So, into our topic today, the Book of Acts, I would like to start off with the topic of who wrote the Book of Acts.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Obviously, the person who wrote the Book of Acts is also pretty much everybody agrees is the same person who wrote the Gospel, according to Luke. And pretty much all the patristic and manuscript evidence that we have attributes the Gospel to Luke. And there's strong evidence suggesting that the author of Acts was a traveling companion of Paul, which helps us not just narrow it down from the patristic evidence, but also the internal evidence. And when I say patristic evidence, of course, I'm talking about like the early church fathers and writers and different things like that. And so to kind of give you a sampling of some of the patristic evidence, we do have as early as 150 AD, Justin Martyr, who, while he doesn't mention Luke or even any of the four gospel writers by name, he does say that the gospels, he calls them memoirs, and he says that they were written by either Jesus's apostles or their followers. Okay, so we do know that, at least according to the book of Acts, that the author of Acts seems to be claiming from the we passages that he is a follower of the apostle Paul. And then, of course, we know that Mark, he was not a one of the 12, but he was, according to all the church fathers, somebody who interpreted, was like Peter's interpreter, and traveled with him to Rome. And so it's at least consistent, even though he doesn't mention, like I said, Luke by name, it is consistent with the other data that we have. And it's also interesting to note that Justin Martyr had a student named Tatian, who created a book called the Diatessaron. The word Diatessaron means through four. And it was basically like a harmony of the four gospels. And it was our four gospels, including the gospel according to Luke. This was in 170 AD. And so now we do get some church fathers who start naming Luke. And we have like Irenaeus, who says that he was a companion of Paul in Against Heresies 3. Book 3. And then Irenaeus is very noteworthy because he was a student of the church father Polycarp, and who was a student of John, according to Irenaeus. And so that was just makes him one step removed from the apostles, so he was definitely in a very good position to know. And then, of course, we have like Clement of Alexandria, who mentions Luke was the gospel author. We also have Tertullian, who mentions that Luke was the author. And we also have the what's known as the Muratorian fragment, which is the earliest known New Testament canonical list that we have, dating at around 180 to 200 maybe. And he identifies Luke as the author of the third gospel. And so we have very strong patristic evidence that Luke was definitely the author. And then there's, of course, every scrap of manuscript evidence that we have says that Luke was the author. Every basically like close to full manuscript that we have, it attributes it to Luke. Starting back with the Greek manuscript that's referred to as P75, dating to the 2nd and 3rd century. And we have basically between the 2nd and the 5th century, we have six manuscripts. All of them either say Gospel according to Luke or according to Luke. And there just is no rival tradition that actually exists. And so I think when you take into consideration that all this evidence is pretty geographically diverse, you got Irenaeus, who is writing in the area which is now known as France. You have Tertullian, who is writing in Carthage. You have Clement, who is writing in Alexandria. You have Justin Martyr, who may have been writing in Rome. That's also where the Muratorian fragment was discovered, was in around that area. And so it's geographically diverse. There's also the fact that the author in the book, I mean, if you just look at it, there's a prologue written to Theophilus. And I know like the skeptics are really fond of saying, hey, well, obviously the Gospels, they're anonymous. Well, sure, Luke's name isn't formally written in the book, but that's hardly surprising because we see that with a lot of historical books at that time. And he does address, like I said, this book to Theophilus twice, both the book of Acts and the Gospel of Luke. And so it's really improbable that like this book was initially anonymous. I mean, he's writing to somebody. That person probably knew who wrote it. And one other interesting point, and I could go on and on about authorship, but is that when you look at the other apocryphal gospels, you have like the Gospel of Thomas, who's a disciple, right? You have the Gospel of Peter, right? Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Judas. You have all these apocryphal gospels. They're all claimed to have been written by an apostle and an eyewitness. But Luke, he's not an eyewitness, right? Why even attribute the gospel to Luke? He's barely even mentioned in the New Testament. So if this is made up, Luke is just kind of a very strange attribution to just try and invent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, the manuscript evidence for not just the Gospel of Luke, but for all of them, is something I really wasn't well acquainted with until I read Brant Petrie's book, The Case for Jesus. Like, I would run into like the evidence for the patristic evidence, the attributions of the early church fathers, like all of the early church fathers saying, oh, these guys wrote these gospels and stuff. But the manuscript evidence that literally every ancient manuscript we have has their names on them. There's, like you said, there's variety of how it's worded, but the attribution is the same. I find that to be a really strong argument, especially since, you know, Petrie, he goes on to give an example with the book of Hebrews, and he says, look, this is what true anonymous authorship looks like. And you have so many people attributing, some say, okay, Paul wrote Hebrews. Some leave Hebrews without an author. Some say it was like Luke or Barnabas. But you don't have that with the Gospels. You have everybody's on the same page. All the manuscripts say the same thing. But with Hebrews, there's a lot of different conflicting manuscript evidence. And I remember one, as far as church fathers goes, one of them says, who wrote the book of Hebrews? Only God knows.
Right. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, that's what true anonymous authorship looks like, is you would have all these different rival traditions. But we don't have that with any of the four Gospels. And we definitely don't have it with Luke's Gospel. And as I said, this is pertinent to the book of Acts, because everybody agrees that it's very, very obvious that whoever wrote the book of Acts is also the same author of the Gospel of Luke. And so, no, that's a really good point. I like Petrie's point there. It's a good one.
Yeah, and I made that point as well in my the point about the two connections to Theophilus. Like in Luke 1, he says, many people have undertaken to compile an account of the things that were done among us. So I'm going to do it for you, most excellent Theophilus. And then in Acts 1, he says, in my former book, Theophilus, I told you all about what Jesus said and did. You know, those are very bad paraphrases. I don't have the text right in front of me, but, Would it be like safe to say that even like does everyone agree that even if they don't agree on who wrote Luke, that whoever wrote Luke, that was also whoever wrote Acts?
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody, even, you know, among skeptical scholars, that contest that like it was a different author. I'm pretty sure that it's like just across the board, everybody agrees that it is the same author. And so So, there's just no disagreement there.
Yeah. Yeah, so, like, even if somebody were to say, well, I think that some Joe Schmo, I think a guy named George wrote the Gospel of Luke, well, then that would mean George wrote Acts.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So whoever it is, it's the same guy.
Yeah, but the evidence is in favor of Lucan authorship.
Yeah, all the patristic evidence, and then, as I'm sure we'll go along, Evan, you're going to see the internal evidence too, and we could kind of come, I think we can circle back when we talk about some of the internal evidence, how it's like very, very consistent that it was written by an eyewitness. And when you kind of narrow it down through the process of elimination, Luke is absolutely the best candidate, just judging from internal evidence only, which is 100% consistent with the patristic evidence.
So, moving on from authorship, let's talk about dating. When was Acts written? Like, how far after the events Acts describes was this book written down?
Yeah, I mean, you have skeptical scholars or even maybe some more moderate scholars who would say that, like, Acts was probably written 85 AD. Now, for Ehrman, he's going to say, well, that's too late because that's long after Paul was dead and he probably wasn't a witness and different things like that. I don't think that 85 necessarily eliminates the fact that Luke still could have wrote it and still could have been an eyewitness. He just would have written it 20 years later. However, I tend to think that the authorship of Luke Acts is probably more in the 60s. And the biggest reason for that is just the complete absence of Paul's death, which I think is significant evidence. Because now a lot of people will say, well, no, Eric, you know, aren't you like Mr. Anti-Argument from Silence? But what I'm not talking about like a weak argument from silence here. I'm talking about an argument that comes from the very purpose of the book itself. And so Luke closely followed Paul's movements all the way up to the end of the book. And then at the end of the book, Paul is still alive and kicking his heels in Rome, even though he's, you know, basically imprisoned. He's just awaiting for trial before Caesar. But again, like I said, Luke closely followed Paul's movements all the way to the end of the book. And the absence of Paul's anticipated hearing before the emperor is kind of strange, because Luke really likes court scenes. He has, you know, Paul testifying before Felix and Agrippa and all of these different people. And yet all of a sudden we're not going to get that particular court scene before Caesar. And then also, as we talked about, this book was dedicated to Theophilus. So why would the author delay sending the book to Theophilus for over 10 to 20 years? It just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And so I think it's all of these different points that kind of converge. The lack of information about Paul, what happened to his trial, how did he die? We know that he died sometime in the 60s, and that this just goes unmentioned, and that's the very purpose of the book. And Luke just kind of leaves that dangling there. And again, why would you dedicate a book to somebody and then you have all this information and you just sit on it for 10 to 20 years? It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You think that Luke would want to conclude it and get to Theophilus as quickly as possible. And so I think those arguments kind of weigh heavily in favor for early dating for me. And I know that there's other scholars who argue like similar vein. One more recent one is Jonathan Bernier, who wrote a book called Rethinking the Dating of the New Testament. I believe that's the name of the book. Really good book. I recommend, you know, people go out and get it. It's not, he's not like a Christian apologist trying to, like, the guy is very, very scholarly in his approach. And he also dates the book within the early 60s. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming from there with that. Ultimately, though, as interesting as the dating stuff is, and I'm sure we're going to talk about here, what's even more interesting is that we have tons of evidence, a mountain, I would say an avalanche of evidence, that this book was written by somebody who was an eyewitness and a traveling companion to Paul, who was very close up to the facts, and who was definitely trying to get things right and was habitually truthful and reliable.
There's, and it's not just Paul's death. I think, like, there's a lot of things that I would imagine that the author of Acts would include, because, like, Peter's death. Peter was a major figure. James, the brother of Jesus, his death, as it's not mentioned in Acts, but Josephus mentions it, and the huge Neronic persecution, the persecution of the emperor Nero upon the church. There's just so much that would be relevant to church history, the developing early church, that just doesn't. I said in my blog and podcast series that the Book of Acts kind of reads like a television show that got canceled due to bad ratings.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of a good way of putting it. It's just kind of like you're left just completely hanging. Like, okay, like, what happened? And so there are, you know, people who try and say, well, you know, Luke was being really crafty and this is just some sort of like literary reason that he did that. But none of those particular reasons that they give for that are very compelling, in my opinion. They just kind of all reek of, I don't know. They're just not very satisfying. And so, I would say that there's more going for the earliness of it. I think the only reason that people want to date it late is because Luke, like the other Gospels, portrays, you know, Jerusalem being destroyed and Jesus made this prophecy and, you know, that's, wow, look, it's been fulfilled now. You know, guys, can't you see that? And they're trying to say that, you know, these gospel authors put these words into Jesus' mouth to make him look like a more impressive prophet. But if that's your argument for late dating, then you're just starting with a presupposition of of anti-supernaturalism, and that prophecy just isn't a thing. And I just think there's a whole lot more in favor for dating it early than there would be dating it later.
How would you respond to the argument for that Luke and therefore Acts has to be later because Jesus, you know, made these very vivid and in detailed predictions? Is there an argument to be made other than just saying, well, you can't do that because you're presupposing naturalism?
I mean, it's interesting, like when Matthew talks about, or I think Mark talks about it, he says, pray that your flight doesn't happen in winter. And then it's oddly enough, when Titus did sack Jerusalem, I believe historians tell us that it was from spring through fall that event took place. And so so there's that. I mean, it's just kind of a weird thing to bring up. I have a whole article on that particular topic. There's more to it than just that. But there's several points raised that, like, it doesn't look like this is something that they just made up. I mean, he also says that the temple won't, every stone will be thrown down. Well, we know that there's, like, the Wailing Wall, and there was still that wall that was kind of left. That doesn't seem like something that you would kind of likely make up, unless you're just going to say that Jesus was maybe kind of like using hyperbole or something like that. And so there's different things like that. When you actually, like, look at the prophecy and then you look, like, how it was fulfilled, you would think that they would make things align a little bit more to make it seem a little more impressive. So those would be some things that I would take into consideration there.
In biblical archaeology, I'm got ahead of myself. Let's talk about external evidence that kind of corroborates the Book of Acts. Things like extra biblical writings, archaeological findings like coins and slabs and all that stuff. That could you list? You know, maybe four or five examples.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. It's really crazy. There's a book by the name of The Setting of Acts, or The Book of Acts and the Setting of Hellenistic History, written by Colin Hemmer, who is a classical historian. And he actually details 84, like, difficult facts that would be hard to get right if you weren't actually there. Because let's remember, like, there was no Google, there was no Wikipedia, there was no modern libraries. And yet Luke details a whole bunch of, like I said, facts that show local knowledge that would be hard to get right from your guesswork. And this is over, remember that Paul traveled, like, to a lot of different places. And so there's, like, a lot of diverse kind of geography here. And so one would be, well, there's a whole list, and there's, like, local titles. Like, this is just kind of one example of kind of evidence. And so Luke gets the proper designation for magistrates of the colony, which is strategoi, following the general term archontes, which is we see in verse 19 of chapter 16. He gets the proper term politarchs, used to the magistrates in Thessalonica. So these people, they all had, you know, depending on the region, they had these different kind of title names. There's the term Areopagites, which is derived from Areopagos. This is the correct title for a member of the court of Athens. And so those are some of the local titles that he gets right. One that I find to be pretty interesting is that he gets the correct title Grammatus for the chief executive magistrate in Ephesus, where there was that riot in chapter 19. And then he tells us, he indicates that the city clerk told the crowd that there are proconsuls in Acts 19:38, and this is where I think it's, like, really obvious that, like, somebody who was, they would have to be there, and this is kind of more of a date for even early, or an argument for early dating, because this is hard information to get right for this particular time. And the reason why is a proconsul is a Roman authority to whom one might take a complaint, and normally there is only one. So Luke just casually mentions the term twice, proconsuls, Anthropoi, and it turns out at that particular time, and that time only, there was in fact two, because there was an assassination by poisoning of the previous proconsul Silanus, in the fall of 54 AD, and this is backed up in Tacitus's Annals, book 13. And so it's like, whoa, like that's kind of crazy. And so he also gets all kinds of things right, like geography, sea routes, landmarks. He knows that the proper port Perga is for the ship crossing from Cyprus. He names another proper port, Italia, that returning travelers would use. He correctly names the place of the sailor's landmark, Samothrace. And he gets the correct implication that sea travel is the most convenient way of reaching Athens in chapter 17, with the favoring Etesian winds with the summer sailing of the season. And then he gets other kinds of local knowledge, right? Like, well, he mentions that Lydia is a seller of purple dye or fabric in Thyatira, an Asian city that actually we know from history was known for its purple dye trade. He even gets slang right when the Athenians call Paul a seed picker. That's a slang word. It's kind of an insult there. Like, he's a dumb hick, you know, kind of a thing. And there's just all kinds of things. We have altars to an unknown god that are mentioned by Pausanias and Diogenes. And so that's something. When he talks about in Athens, he saw those altars to an unknown god. And so I know you asked for like 4 or 5. I probably gave you like 15, just machine gun them out there. But over and over and over again, there's like all of these little details that Luke gets right. And so, again, no Google, no Wikipedia, no modern libraries to look all this stuff up. So I think this is best explained by somebody who was familiar with the area, traveled with somebody. And well, what is so weird about somebody traveling with the Apostle Paul? We know he traveled. We know he did missionary journeys. We know he had traveling companions. So yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's fine about how many examples you gave. The more the merrier, because when it comes to that kind of argument, it is cumulative. So the more examples you give, the stronger of a case that you can make.
Right.
Now, a similar, a different but related question is this. In biblical archaeology, there's a trend where a biblical book, and this goes for both the Old Testament and the New Testament, scholars will say that it got something wrong in some historical detail because they say there's no historical evidence for it. But then years later, archaeology uncovers evidence and it shows that that biblical book was right all along. For example, you know, the Pool of Bethesda was in doubt in the Gospel of John for many years, and then later it was discovered, and it had 5 porticos, just as John described. And for the Old Testament, the existence of the Amorites was doubted for a time, but then evidence came along, and sure enough, there were a people group back then known as the Amorites. Are there any examples of this when it comes to the Book of Acts? Are there any examples where Acts recorded something? Scholars said, oh, well, that can't be. Luke or whoever must have obviously got that wrong, didn't know what he was talking about. But then later, archaeology uncovered a slab or a tomb or whatever and vindicated Acts.
Yeah. Definitely. And so skeptics kind of doubted the existence of Sergius Paulus. And they claimed that any leader that was from his area, this is in Acts 13, would have been called a properator, I think. I'm probably mispronouncing that rather than a proconsul, because in Acts 13, Luke describes him as a proconsul. But there was an inscription that was discovered at Soli in Cyprus that acknowledged Paulus and identified him as proconsul. And it's not just like one inscription. There's like, we have multiple inscriptions about Sergius Paulus. There's the Soli inscription, which confirms the Paulus family presence on Cyprus and their association with the role of proconsul. And then we also have inscriptions from Pisidian Antioch that suggest the proximity of the Paulus family estate. Acts 13 also interestingly records Saul. He was called Saul up until this time. And then he changed his name to Paul, and it seems like this change happened after leading Sergius Paulus to faith. Subsequently, Paul and Barnabas' journey to Pisidian Antioch, where scholars speculate Paul may have shared the gospel with the rest of his family. So, like, Paul jumps off and apparently, it looks like, goes to his family. Now, again, some of this is a little on the speculative end, but it makes good sense. And then there's a Tiber River inscription from Rome that indicates that Sergius Paulus held other significant positions within the Roman Empire. And what's interesting is Sergius Paulus is mentioned by Luke as an intelligent man. And Pliny the Elder's book, Natural History, mentions a guy by the name of Sergius Paulus as kind of fitting that same description, affirming his historical presence. And so I think that's like one really big example that I find to be pretty interesting. You also have Gallio, which just everybody, like, this is basically the discovery of the Gallio inscription is how we date the book of 1 Corinthians, basically. And so during his second missionary journey, the Apostle Paul spent about a year and a half in Corinth. In Acts 18:2, it's mentioned that during the time when Gallio served as proconsul of Achaia, I believe that's how it's pronounced, the Jews brought Paul before a tribunal. Well, we found the inscription called the Delphi inscription, and it consists of 9 fragments found in Delphi, Greece. It's written by the Emperor Claudius and mentions Junius Gallio, my friend and proconsul, indicating Gallio's role regarding the cult of Apollo at Delphi. The inscription's date falls between January and August of AD 52, during Claudius's 26th imperial acclamation. Historians tell us that the proconsuls typically started their one-year terms in May. Therefore, Gallio served as proconsul of Achaia from May 1st, AD 51, to the end of April, AD 52. And so it's with this information we can pinpoint when Paul was in Corinth, that he faced Jews and appeared before Gallio's tribunal in around the middle of AD 51. And it provides like a fixed marker for Paul's ministry of when he was in Corinth and early church history. And so it just helps us to date those things. And so I think that one's a biggie that pretty much everyone, even skeptics I know, kind of universally acknowledge. And so those are a couple. I'm sure when we talk about like undesigned coincidences, we'll work in another one there. But there are like three, like I would say, like really interesting archaeological discoveries that confirm the Book of Acts. There are more, but there are three that are, I guess you could say, are like kind of more popular.
So we've talked about external evidence. Let's move on to internal evidence. You already mentioned the concept of undesigned coincidences. You're a fan of the argument from undesigned coincidences. So am I. I'd like to talk about that first. For those who might not know what an undesigned coincidence is, because I mean, even though I talked about undesigned coincidences several podcast episodes ago, I don't assume that everybody watches all of these episodes in chronological order like I do. So if somebody just decided to pick this out randomly, this episode, then they'll need some background information on that. So yeah, first explain what an undesigned coincidence is, and secondly, are there any that confirm the historical reliability of the Book of Acts?
Sure. Well, the term undesigned coincidence is, I believe, was coined by William Paley. He was a Christian apologist in the 18th century during the Deist controversy. And then there was another author, J.J. Blunt, who kind of picked up the argument. And Paley is actually the guy when it comes to undesigned coincidences between the Book of Acts and the Pauline epistles, because he wrote a whole book on it called the Horae Pauline. But basically, an undesigned coincidence is sometimes you have like two works by different authors that interlock in a way that would be very unlikely if one of them were copied from another or both were copied from a common source. And so, like, one book may mention in passing, like, a small detail, like, they'll just mention it casually, and that detail answers some question raised by another, and that the two records fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And so, say you have, like, just to use kind of like a modern real-life example, say there's, like, a bank robber, and one witness says that he saw the bank robber trip, okay? And then another witness mentions that the bank robber's shoes were untied, okay? Well, that kind of explains the tripping, but, like, nobody's providing the whole picture, right? The shoes untied explains the tripping, but it's, like, only when you have both little incidental details put together that you get the full picture. Does that make sense?
I used a real life example in my introduction to the Undesigned Coincidences. It's like a trip to Myrtle Beach that my family took when I was 12, and there was it was bad timing because there was a tropical storm, and so in my version, in my sister's version, we talk about like all the stuff we did, and it ends with my sister mentioned seeing a flying porta potty. Well, what the heck is that about? But then you hear my version of the story. I don't mention the flying porta potty, but I mention, man, it was just a really bad time. There was a tropical storm, and you know, the wind was so strong I could lean into it without falling over. And like, I don't know that my sister all gave her your version of the story, but they sort of explain and connect in a way that just, it's not the kind of thing that fiction authors would do.
Right, yeah. If you're writing fiction, you don't want to leave loose ends like that, right? Or if you do try and connect the dots, you do it in such a way that's like overt, and that you kind of draw an attention that like, hey, you know, I'm making this connection, guys. And so, yeah, it's incidental, it's casual, it appears to come across in an undesigned way, thus the name. And they just kind of coincidentally kind of fit together in a way that just gives you a clear picture. And this is what is expected when we have eyewitness testimony, but this isn't what we really expect when somebody's just embellishing the facts, or making things up, you know, completely whole cloth out of their head and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, what kinds of undesigned coincidences are there with acts that would support its reliability?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch. I'll give you a few examples here. And so they would obviously dovetail between Paul's letters and the Book of Acts is where you see a lot of them. So just to give you an example, in 2 Corinthians 3:1, Paul writes, "Are we beginning to commend ourselves again, or do we need, as some of you do, letters of recommendation to you or from you?" Well, it's kind of like, you know, what's Paul getting kind of snippy about here? That's kind of weird. Where does this letters of recommendation come from? But if you flip over into Acts 18:27, it says, when Apollos wished to cross to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. And so, well, we know that Augustus made Corinth the capital of Achaia, and here's Apollos coming to the Corinthians with letters of recommendation from, you know. And so, like, again, these are just little incidental details that kind of fill out a full picture. But you can take this example and go a little bit further. In 1 Corinthians 1:14 through 17, Paul is talking about, hey, you know, I didn't baptize any of you except a couple of you. And Christ didn't send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. And then he goes on to say, not with wisdom and eloquence, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Well, in Acts 18:24, when it's describing Apollos, it says that he was an Alexandrian and that he was an eloquent man. And so it mentions like his eloquence, right? And then, of course, we know later on in 1 Corinthians that like Paul was there and Apollos came later and watered. And then that's exactly what we see in the book of Acts. In the book of Acts, in chapter 18, Paul was there in Corinth at the beginning. And then later on, towards the end of the chapter, we see, again, Apollos coming. And so Paul says, you know, I planted, Apollos watered, but it's God who gave the increase. And so I think it's reasonable to assume that in the Corinthian church, with all their factional strife, critics targeted Paul's lack of, like, charisma. He lacked the riz, as the kids would say, and eloquence there, favoring Apollos, who is known for his eloquence. And so these are all details that I think like dovetail very well together, not weather. You got me going with the flying porta potty there, I guess. and then you have the timing of the visits and all that other stuff that all accord one together. But if you're looking at Acts 18 and all of this, it doesn't look like that he's like copying these details from 1 Corinthians. And there's also scholars who don't even think that Luke had access to Paul's letters, and maybe we can talk about that. But yeah, all of these things fit together, but none of it looks like as a result of copying. It's all these incidental kind of casual details. So those are like three examples just like bunched within the first few chapters of 1 Corinthians and the book of Acts, chapter 18. And I can give more examples if you want.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this one, again, kind of ties not only into between the epistles and the book of Acts, but also it ties back into the archaeology stuff that we were talking about. And so in 1 Corinthians 4:17, Paul talks about sending Timothy, and he says, "That is why I sent to you Timothy." So we see that Timothy has already been sent. Okay, so Timothy's on his way. But in 1 Corinthians 16:10, it says when Timothy comes. And so Paul actually expects the letter of 1 Corinthians to arrive before Timothy actually gets there. And so we can therefore infer that Timothy must have taken some indirect route to Corinth. Because normally, when you're going from where Paul was writing, there's just, you cross the sea, and you're there, you're in Corinth, right? But in Acts, it looks like, according to 1 Corinthians, we don't really know what route Timothy took, but it wasn't the short route. But in Acts 19:21 through 22, we do see that Timothy did take some kind of indirect route, and that he actually went up and around through Macedonia. And so, unfortunately, this is a podcast, I don't have like a map, but it looks like Paul was writing from Ephesus is where he wrote the letter. And it looks like Timothy went up to Troas, and then there's the Aegean Sea, and there's just like a little very, very short boat trip versus more of a longer boat trip. And then around through Macedonia and into Corinth. And that's exactly what we find in Acts 19:21 through 22 being described. Now, interestingly enough, in Acts 19:21 through 22, one of Timothy's traveling buddies was a guy by the name of Erastus. And in Romans 16:23, Paul mentions an Erastus, and he says that he was actually the city treasurer to Corinth. So Erastus is like heading back home with Timothy. And we have an archaeological discovery, a pavement slab in ancient Corinth that Erastus funded this pavement slab. And here we know he's also the city treasurer. And so Timothy headed to Corinth with someone known to reside there. I find that to be like, you know, really, really interesting, all of these different connections there. And then, like I was saying, this was something that we found archaeologically. In 1929, archaeologists found this inscription, and the letters in the inscription were originally filled with bronze. They stand 7 inches high, although they're now hollow. And it appears to be from the inscription that Erastus was an elected official who was responsible for maintaining public buildings, street upkeep, market oversight, managing local games, like the Isthmian Games in Corinth that happened every 2 years. And so while we can't be 100% certain that this is the same Erastus, I think the clues like very strongly, compellingly point in that direction.
Yeah, those are some good examples. So let's move on to the issue of contradictions. This is like the skeptic's favorite argument against historical reliability. I'm going to quote from Bart Ehrman's book, but before we do, let's talk about how important is the issue of contradictions. Like, does the Christian apologist have to refute every single contradiction, like the comically long list that the skeptic loves to bring out, before he can conclude the book of Acts is reliable, or any book of the Bible for that matter, the Gospels, you know, 1 Samuel, whatever he might be arguing.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of, like, I think we're going to see here, Evan, that, like, a lot of the contradictions that Ehrman raises are actually quite easily harmonizable. Now, I know, like, a lot of people, skeptics, are just like, oh, you Christians, you're just dedicated to this book being inerrant, and so you're going to, like, cram jam all of the information together to make this thing come out right. But actually, these are quite plausible harmonizations, and we know in secular history that when we have two reliable sources that you know, and I'm not talking about like super duper reliable, I'm just talking about like generally reliable, we harmonize. It's not a weird thing to harmonize. So don't let people like shame you that harmonization is this thing that fundy Christians do in order to make everything come out right. Second of all, the positive confirmation for the Book of Acts, I think, far outweighs any of the contradictions that we might find, apparent contradictions, in the Book of Acts. And so, like I said, we have 84 difficult facts from history that Luke gets right. We have all of these undesigned coincidences. I mean, I just named, like, you know, four or five. There are dozens and dozens of them. I think William Paley lists, like, 60 to 80 in his book, Horae Polynae. And so you have all of this, like, overwhelming positive confirmation that whoever wrote this book probably was a traveling companion of Paul. And so you can't just whip out, like, five or six pet contradictions, as Ehrman does, and then just try and make all of this evidence go away. I would say there's, like, a kind of like an epistemic asymmetry here, where it's like you have dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of positive confirmations. And in the case really of the Book of Acts and the letters of Paul, you really only have a handful of contradictions. And most of those contradictions are like really easily explainable and harmonizable in a way that doesn't take, you know, mental gymnastics and different things like that. And so, no, I think even if, like, with that information in mind, even if there was a discrepancy that you found that you're like, I'm not really sure how to deal with that one, I don't think that you absolutely have to have, like, this is the knockdown answer to this particular thing because of all that positive evidence. You can't just, like, throw one contradiction out there and that sinks the whole thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The way I see it is, like, when you are, like, when you're making a case for the resurrection of Jesus on the basis of the Gospels or any claim about Jesus on the basis of the Gospels, or, you know, you're making claims about the early church on the basis of Acts or anything, you're not treating these books as scripture. You're treating them as historical records. And I think, like you said, if you've got all this evidence that they've got a whole lot of things right, they were there, these are eyewitness testimonies, they're early, and they can just be confirmed both externally and internally at so many different points. I agree with you that just outweighs any evidence that a supposed contradiction might throw, you know, might be sought to cast upon the document. Because, you know, even the most reliable and trustworthy people get minor things wrong sometimes. You know, people make good faith errors. It happens. Right. Now, that, you know, that would cause a problem for biblical inerrancy, and that would, you know, raise theological questions, but it's negligible from a historian's perspective.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, like I said, there's just not like the kind of contradictions that Bart Ehrman, what Ehrman is going to try and say is that there's like dozens and dozens of them, and that sinks the reliability. But even in my study of, like, the Book of Acts, when Ehrman talks about Acts, he only throws out about five or six. And I think you'll see they're, for the most part, like, not really that impressive at all.
Yeah. So let's move on to those examples that Ehrman gives. First example, Ehrman quotes Galatians 1, verses 16 to 20. He says, quote, "I was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles. I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia and returned again to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him for 15 days. But I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. And what I am writing to you before God, I do not lie," end quote. Now, that's Paul in Galatians 1. About this, Ehrman writes, quote, "This emphatic statement that Paul is not lying should give us pause. He is completely clear. He did not consult with others after his conversion, did not see any of the apostles for 3 years, and even then he did not see any except Cephas, Peter, and Jesus' brother James. This makes the account found in the book of Acts very interesting indeed, for according to Acts 9, immediately after Paul converted, he'd spent some time in Damascus with the disciples, and when he left the city, he headed directly to Jerusalem, where he met with the apostles of Jesus, Acts chapter 9, verses 19 to 30. On all counts, Acts seems to be at odds with Paul. Did he spend time with other Christians immediately, Acts, or not, as Paul says, end quote. How do you respond to this?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you actually look at what Acts 9 says, it says, when many days passed, the Jews plotted to kill him, but their plot became known to Saul. They were watching the gates day and night to kill him, but the disciples took him by night and let him down through the opening of the wall, lowering him in a basket. So the big problem here is, like, the period of time, and it's denoted by the time many days. Well, many days, how long can many days be? The expression is actually indefinite and can mean any longish span of time. I mean, we see in 1 Kings chapter, I know this is an Old Testament book. I'm not trying to say, like, we're not using the Bible all as one source here, but in 1 Kings 2:38-39, it says many days in Hebrew is immediately glossed over as 3 years. And so some part of three consecutive years, as we would reckon it, you know, that covers a period of many days. And so, I mean, that would be one thing that I would say in response. And so there's a New Testament commentator. His name is Timothy George. He says, how could Paul have at once both preached in Damascus and then gone off to Arabia? He says that this difficulty disappears altogether if we follow the literal sequence of the Greek text and interpret immediately as qualifying Paul's negative statements concerning his post-conversion whereabouts. Clearly, the point he was making was not that he went immediately to Arabia without doing anything at all in Damascus, but rather that immediately after his conversion, he didn't go to Jerusalem or consult the apostles there. Moreover, there is the problem, well, did Paul spend time with Christians or did he not? Well, Thomas Schreiner notes, another New Testament scholar, that Paul's point is that he didn't query others about the legitimacy of the revelation that he received. He knew without a doubt that he had been called as an apostle of Jesus. And so that answers that particular question. And then Colin Hember, who I mentioned earlier, because there's the question, well, did Paul make a beeline to the apostles or did he not? Because, you know, you get two different stories, it seems like, in Galatians 1 and in Acts chapter 9. And Hemmer notes that it is, I think, needless to quarrel with Luke's vaguer expression or to ask how many constituted a quorum of the whole body. Luke says Paul had apostolic contact. Paul tells us who he saw. The other matter goes deeper. Here we find at least one suggestive implication common to both accounts, that Paul's introduction to the church was oddly limited and difficult. In the one case, he met few individuals and was unknown to the church at large. In the other church, they feared him and disbelieved his conversion. It seems very likely those two things go together. And so Luke mentions that the church was initially suspicious of Luke until Barnabas vouched for him. This explains why Paul mentioned the meeting with James and Peter, who likely investigated his conversion on the behalf of the apostles. Therefore, I don't really think there's a contradiction here. And we can even go a little bit further here and say that there's actually kind of another undesigned coincidence here. If Acts was really written by someone who had no access to the story of Paul's conversion, why, of all places, did he mention Damascus? Damascus doesn't even feature prominently in the rest of the book of Acts. But if Paul is like copying from, or Paul, if Luke is copying from the book of Galatians, he wouldn't have put Damascus into his story without leaving out Paul's trip to Arabia or to the passing of the 3 years. So either Luke is just like really carefully devious to include a small detail like Damascus, while at the same time being a major blunderer by leaving out the trip to Arabia. And so what I'm saying here, Evan, is that like there's enough divergence here to show that like you can't explain away all the undesigned coincidences, because some skeptics will try to do this, by saying, well, the author of Acts had access to Luke's letters. This is something that like Richard Pervo tried to suggest, but who is a New Testament scholar and is deceased now. But you can't say that when there's like these discrepancies, but these discrepancies aren't like so difficult that they can't be kind of like plausibly reconciled. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The The next contradiction is regarding Galatians 1:21-22. Ehrman writes, quote, "Here again, Paul is quite clear. Sometime after he converted, he went around to various churches in the regions of Syria and Cilicia, but he was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea, Galatians 1:21-22. This has struck some scholars as odd. According to the book of Acts, when Paul was earlier persecuting the churches in Christ, it was specifically the churches in Judea and Samaria, Acts chapter 8, verses 1-3, chapter 9, verses 1-2. Why is it that Christians in the churches he had formerly persecuted didn't know what he looked like? Wasn't he physically present among them as their enemy earlier? According to Acts, yes. According to Paul, no." End quote.
Yeah, to me, this is like Bart's fundamentalist background coming out. Like, he's being fundamentalist, but like the way that he's reading this, but in like a perverse kind of trying to create a discrepancy kind of way. This is kind of what I would call like a, or Lydia McGrew would call like an artificial disharmonization here. He's just trying to create tension where there really just isn't a whole lot. Acts 8, 1 through 3 shows that Paul was persecuting the Jerusalem church, not the entire region of Judea. Acts 8, 1 says that the believers in Jerusalem were scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria. They probably would have told the other Christians they met about Paul's persecutions, but that means that the Judean Christians would have known Paul by his reputation, not necessarily by sight. And so if you just use like a little bit of common sense and like a little bit of historical imagination, without trying to make this as wooden as Bart is, I don't really think this is one that's really all that difficult to think through at all.
Yeah. When I first read that, my thought was, that doesn't necessarily mean that every last person came into physical contact with them.
Right,
you know, yeah. If I went to New York City, and I, let's say I spoke at an apologetics conference there, that doesn't mean that every single New Yorker saw me.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like, what, Bart, baby, what is you doing? You know, like, come on, like, do better. Like, I could probably come up with a better one than that. The Acts 9 one is like, is a little better. Like, this one is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me like, you know, some of them would have known him by sight, and some of them just would have heard of him because they weren't there because he didn't, they're, you know.
Yeah.
I found that to be probably the weakest one in this list.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, third example is, I'm going to quote from Bart again. He says, quote, "According to Paul's account, the Jerusalem Council was only the second time he had been to Jerusalem, Galatians 1:18 and 2:1. According to Acts, it was his third prolonged trip there, Acts chapters 9, 11, and 15. Once again, it appears that the author of Acts has confused some of Paul's itinerary, possibly intentionally, for his own purposes," end quote.
Yeah, here's what Paul actually writes in Galatians. He says, "Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remain with them 15 days. I saw none other the apostles except James, the Lord's brother." And then in Galatians 2:1, it says, "After 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me." There is actually some debate among Pauline scholars about whether or not what's described in Galatians 2 is the Jerusalem Council that we read about in Acts 15. Bart seems to think like this is the only possible interpretation. Now, he might be right about that, but where exactly does Paul say that this was his second and only his second visit? Acts 11 says that between Paul's two journeys, he did go to Jerusalem to bring aid to those who were undergoing difficulty because of the Jerusalem famine. But why would Paul have mentioned this trip to the Galatians? It has nothing to do with him meeting with the apostles about the gospel message that he was preaching to the Gentiles. And so, I mean, again, if this is the best that Ehrman can come up with in order to create tension, to say that the author of Acts was not an actual eyewitness, like, I feel like he's kind of grasping at straws here. Like, this is not really that difficult.
Now, we've been talking about the case for and against the reliability of the Book of Acts. But some listeners might be wondering, like, why is the reliability of the Book of Acts even important? Why are we even talking about this?
Well, yeah, there's a number of different reasons. And I think you can actually make a pretty strong case for the resurrection just kind of using the Book of Acts. And I'll explain why here. So why are we talking about the Book of Acts and it being reliable? Well, there's a lot of upshot here, I think. Luke states his commitment to factual truth in both of his prologues. And so if we actually see that Luke can be borne out as trying to report the facts, well, I think that's a big deal. And this is an important one here in regards to the resurrection, is Luke claims to have been present with Paul during Paul's visit to the Jerusalem church in Acts 21. When all the elders, including James, were present, this is in Acts 21:18. Luke was also present with Paul during his imprisonment in Caesarea Maritima for at least 2 years, during which time he would have had access to many living witnesses to Jesus' resurrection, since Caesarea is only 75 miles from Jerusalem, where many of the witnesses of the resurrection would have resided. And we know that Luke definitely tells us a lot about the resurrection, right? And so we also see that Luke provides physical details surrounding Paul's conversion, like the traveling companions who saw the light and heard the voice, the following 3 days of blindness that were cured after Ananias prayed, and what the voice said to Paul. Well, I think that was important. Those details are really important because skeptics will kind of try and say, well, you know, Paul, he's real vague. He doesn't talk about what he saw when he saw Jesus. You know, they'll even try and say, well, Galatians 1 says that he revealed his son in me. So it was just this like inner thing that he saw. It wasn't like this real objective thing like we see in like Luke's gospel, for instance, or John's gospel, where people are touching him and he's eating fish and all of these different things. And so, no, Luke actually like differentiates Paul's post-ascension visionary experience from the multi-sensory appearances that were extended across a period of 40 days. So here's kind of more of the payoff here, is that if Luke was a traveling companion of Paul, it would be really surprising if his understanding of the apostolic claim concerning the resurrection differed significantly from that of Paul's. Because again, people are trying to draw this wedge. You know, you got Paul over here, vision. You got the Gospels. Well, those are embellished. We can't really trust those. Well, no, if Luke is a careful writer, then he's not embellishing things. He doesn't feel like he can invent things. He's not just fudging the facts or doing different things. He's trying to report things. He's in a position where he can actually talk to eyewitnesses. He's also a traveling companion of Paul's. So it'd be really weird if Luke's idea of what the resurrection was like, Paul's idea of what the resurrection was like, were different. Another reason why this is important is evidence for the reportage view of the Gospels, like and Acts. Evidence for this view that this is eyewitness reportage, that this is something that's being carefully documented, carefully written down. They're trying to get things correct. It disconfirms other theories about the Book of Acts. You see a lot of this happening now, like if you go on YouTube any length of time, you'll see like MythVision talking about, you know, this is all, you know, being copied from Homer's Odyssey and, you know, goofy stuff like that. No, this view disconfirms that they were borrowing from fictional Greek legends, or that they were just, you know, borrowing from the Old Testament and, you know, making things up, inventing things as they were going along, and just sprinkling in a dab of truth here and there. This picture that we have of Luke trying to get things right gives us a unified picture, right? We're not dealing with somebody who, like, is schizophrenic and at one minute is like, yeah, let's get all these facts right. But then on the other hand, like anytime he's talking about something else, like maybe that involving a miracle, oh yeah, I just feel completely free to invent facts and make things up. And so if Luke was this reliable, he didn't invent things. He was cautious about what he included. He was close to original eyewitnesses. And it appears that he accurately recorded what the witnesses originally claimed about Jesus' resurrection. And what does Luke talk about when it comes to the resurrection? That the disciples ate with him, that he allowed them to touch him, that he appeared to them in groups over a period of 40 days. Such claims are not likely honest mistakes. Moreover, Luke documents that these original eyewitnesses proclaimed these things in front of hostile audiences, and they were arrested for it. They were beaten for it. They were threatened for it. James, the son of Zebedee, was killed for it, right? That they were willing to undergo hardships, dangers, sufferings. It's unlikely that they would have lied about such matters. And so if it's unlikely that they lied, and if it's unlikely that they were just honestly mistaken, like if you're just trying to divorce the Paul's letters from the Gospels and just rely completely on Paul, then you just have this maybe visionary picture of Jesus, and you don't really know what the appearances are like. You know, you put all these things together, and I think you can make a pretty compelling case for the resurrection. Yes, we have the other Gospels, and we should use them, but Luke's Gospel and the Book of Acts, all this historical confirmation, I think make a very compelling case, even on their own, for the resurrection. And then on top of that, we have the ridiculous evidence that we have from all the other three Gospels and the Gospel of John.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Yeah. I remember in their book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, Frank Turek, Norman Geisler, they used like all of the evidence for Acts, and they argued backwards to argue for the reliability of Luke, because, you know, it has the same author. Because really, at the end of the day, technically we're not judging the reliability of books. We're judging the reliabilities of writers.
It's exactly
of authors. Yeah. So if you have well, this guy was like really, really right when he wrote this, what are the odds that he just completely botched this other work that he put his hand to?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so when people do say, well, Luke got the census wrong or something like that, well, when he's getting all these other things right, you kind of give him a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt. Not to mention, there are very good answers to that particular objection, of course. And then, yeah, you make this kind of inductive argument that, well, yeah, he was probably careful in his gospel as well. And as I mentioned in Acts 21, he had ample opportunity to witness people in Jerusalem or to interview people who were witnesses in Jerusalem at that time.
So before we go, is there any content like that you'd like to plug, websites? You already dropped your YouTube channel at the beginning, but is there like anything else that you'd like to plug?
Sure. For people who are interested in studying this topic more about the Book of Acts, there are several books that they can get their hands on. I'll give you a couple, like three free resources, and then I'll go from the more inexpensive to the expensive ones. But there's a book called The Evidential Value of the Acts of the Apostles by a 19th century author by the name of J.S. Howson. That's very, very interesting. There's evidence in there that we didn't even discuss, that they can actually go to Google Play Books and get it for free because it's public domain. You know, it's out of print, and so they can get their hands on that. There's also The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul by James Smith. And I actually have a whole playlist on the reliability of Acts that people can check out, where I actually use Smith's arguments to show that Smith was a sailor who was familiar with the area of Acts 27, kind of where Paul sailed and had his famous shipwreck. And he says that there's a number of nautical, meteorological, if I can say that word correctly, details that he gets right, as well as like things about the particular ship that show that Luke was probably there, but because he was a landsman and not a sailor, he didn't really know why they were doing the things that they were doing, but he describes it just the way that it would probably happen. That one's free. You can get really, really interesting. And then Jorge Polonai is the one that lists like dozens and dozens of undesigned coincidences between the letters of Paul and the Book of Acts. And you can get that for free. Super good book. Well worth checking out. Lydia McGrew has kind of taken Paley's arguments and updated them in a book called Hidden in Plain View. And she has a whole section on the Book of Acts and Paul's letters, like two chapters that she discusses it, and kind of the importance of establishing the reliability of the Book of Acts that we just talked about, you can get on Kindle, I believe, for like only $10 or so. There's also a really good book that that outlines a lot of the evidences that we talked about, whether it's undesigned coincidences or external historical confirmations from archaeology. It's really, really good, really underrated. It's by a guy named Jefferson White, and it's called Evidence in Paul's Journey. It's a short book, easy read, probably only like 150 pages, pretty affordable. You can get on Amazon. Highly recommend that. And if you really want to get down and dirty into this, Colin J. Hemmer, The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History. Awesome, awesome book. Somehow I was able to get a copy, a used copy, for $6.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was just like, you know, like miracles still continue. So, yeah,
yes.
But yeah, it's a little more expensive than that. I was just very fortunate to get that. And then one last one, Acts and Exegetical Commentary by Craig Keener. That's 4 volumes. And while I don't always agree with Craig Keener on some things, I do like his work on miracles, and I do like his commentary on Acts. He tends to look at Acts more the way that I would than, say, maybe his commentary on John. But, you know, we don't have to get into that, obviously. But very, very good. Definitely more expensive. That's one you'd want to save your pennies for, because those are thick, thick books.
Yeah, to this day, I still have not read Colin Hemmer's book, but I have wanted to almost as long as I have been studying apologetics. But it is just it's hard to find, for one thing. And when you do find it, it's like $80, $90, $100, $150. I hope someday I will be able to get a copy of that book, because all of the people who talk about the reliability of the Acts, whether Frank Turek, Lydia McGrew, you, whoever, they're like, Colin Hemmer's book on this is a great resource to go to. And I'm just like, if only I could get my hands on it.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think you can get it on Logos, but I was like a e-copy, but I might be wrong about that. So, yeah, actually, I'm doing a quick Google search and I don't see it. So I guess I'm mistaken on that.
Yeah. So, well, thank you, Eric Manning, for coming on the podcast, talking about this important topic.
Yeah, definitely, man. I'm glad to do it, and hopefully this helps. And again, people can check out my playlist if they want more on this kind of evidence. And yeah, it's been fun. Thanks again for having me.
Before we go, I want to give a shout-out to my patrons, O.C. Jones, Danny Lozano, Marcy Schlafman, Daniel Holstein, David Shannon, Red Blade Flame, Steel Cat, and SlamRN. And if you would like to become a patron and support this ministry financially, go to patreon.com/cerebralfaith. Peace out, God bless, and keep using the brains that God gave you.